From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Welcome back to the show. My name is Matt. Noel is on adventures.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul, Mission Control, Deccant. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this stuff they don't want you to know. This is what I'm pretty excited about, Matt. What about you?
Yeah. It's been a minute since we've really gotten our unexplained phenomena, i.e., UFOs, unidentified flying objects, sometimes unidentified submerged objects, any of those. We're into it.
And we had a lot of people, a lot of our fellow listeners suggest this topic. So we picked one person that we wanted you to hear from directly.
Hey, boys. I'm a big fan of your show, and I really enjoy all the episodes you do. I just had an idea for a great episode. And that's the mystery of the Shag Harbor incident. That was a huge UFO sighting seen by many, many people, actually relatives of personal friends of mine, here in eastern Canada. Happened on the south shore of Nova Scotia back in the 1960s, and not far from Oak Island, right? Another awesome place of mystery. So apparently there was a pretty substantial RCMP investigation into that. And I think it would make for a great episode.
Yes. Thank you, anonymous caller from East Canada over there in Nova Scotia, or near Nova Scotia at least.
Yeah, thank you so much. These are two fantastic ideas that have been on our mutual minds for some time. Oak Island is a story all its own, and we've done some videos on that before, right, Matt?
Yeah, we have. I cannot recall if we've actually made a podcast episode, but we should if we haven't.
Yeah, maybe buried treasure episode or something. Tantalizing story. Shag Harbor, however.
Yes.
That's what we're going to look at today. It has been quite a while, old friend, since we did an episode on UFOs. I, for one, I'm still convinced that various governments are hiding some sort of advanced technology or another. And you, both of us, you especially, Fox Mulder style, still want to believe. Is that correct?
Oh, very much true. Especially with something like the incident we're going to discuss today. Our caller said that, you know, a bunch of people witnessed this thing. And it is true that I would say dozens – I think dozens of people did witness this at some point during the official incident. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a ton of people. It's not like it was over a large city and a bunch of, you know, everyone had their cell phones or something. We're talking 1967. But enough people saw it that it wasn't just a trick of the light that, you know, a captain on a ship saw or, you know, maybe a meteor that could be explained pretty easily.
Or something funky on the horizon seen by a pilot.
Exactly. There are more vantages to this than a lot of UFO sightings.
This is one of the most well-documented UFO sightings in modern history, to be honest. They call it Canada's Roswell, and that's not an ironic name like Little John or something.
Yeah.
This really is one of the most historically significant, well-known and famous or infamous UFO sightings in Canadian history, if not the most famous. So we received tons of great episodes for specific UFO sightings. We get them a lot. This one we were curious about because if you're not from Canada and you don't spend much time thinking about UFOs, you probably have not heard of Shag Harbor. A lot of people who are ufologists in the United States may not have heard of this, but here are the facts. Shag Harbor is a tiny, tiny town, a village really, and it is, as our caller said, on the southern shore of Nova Scotia. The population is somewhere between – it's under 500 people. It's 400, 450 people or so, and their big business is lobster, which I love this because lobster is amazing, but here where we're based in landlocked Atlanta, Georgia – you get what you pay for.
Yeah, yeah. And just so you have an idea of where this is, if you do live in the United States, as do most of you out there listening, we know this. If you are in Portland, Maine, so if you're imagining Portland, Maine, way up there in the northeast section of the United States, and you essentially go east, it's not perfectly east because we live, you know, on a globe, but if you look east on a map and you just travel that till you hit Nova Scotia, you essentially hit Shag Harbor, just to know exactly where you are, because Nova Scotia is essentially a peninsula that comes down. It's close to an island, but it's a peninsula that comes down off of Canada up on the top there.
Mm-hmm. On the eastern side, yeah. And this fishing community, right, most of their business in the fishing industry takes place from November to May. Mm-hmm. That's going to be important for the story as it unfolds. On a side note, I just checked downstairs at one of the only places that does sell lobster rolls.
Yes.
Here in the area, $24 for one.
For like a small lobster roll, right?
For just a regular lobster roll.
And that's, of course, to get that lobster to Atlanta and then buy it in Ponce City Market.
Oh, boy.
Now, just saying, it might be a little inflated. That's all. That's all.
One day, Matt, maybe one day I'll treat myself to a lobster. You know what? I might just – at this point, maybe I should just fly to Maine or Nova Scotia.
Let's look at Dave's Lobster in Halifax. Let's see. Let's see if they've got a menu.
I looked up some places in Shag Harbor.
No way.
There, I couldn't get the website for Captain Wayne's to work, but I'm interested. So if you're listening, you've ever been to Captain Wayne's in Shag Harbor, let me know what you think and let me know what I should order when I go there. Because after doing this research, I'm excited about taking a trip there one day.
I'd like to go. That would be wonderful. We should definitely do that.
And while we're there, we can check out the Chapel Hill Museum,
yes.
Captain Wayne's, and some other restaurants, a few tourism sites. But what sort of tourism sites, you may ask?
Well, you know, a lot of people would probably go out there for fishing or maybe to try and catch their own lobster.
Dude, that would be so cool. Some people may visit for the history of Chapel Hill, which is a historically significant site, but many people visit for a different reason. They visit Shag Harbor, you see, because they are convinced that human beings saw a UFO, not even a UFO, an extraterrestrial object in this town in the 1960s. Here's where it gets crazy. So let's get our primary sources for this right, and we'll go with the official story, and then we'll go with some speculation. And then we'll go with some analysis.
That sounds great.
I feel like I'm over-explaining it. That's very Alice in Wonderland, where the Hatter says, start at the beginning, go through the middle, and when you get to the end, stop.
No, signposts, in my opinion, are actually good. So let's keep with them.
Okay. All right. Well, we've made a promise now, Matt, so we'll have to try to keep our story straight, which is a problem in the Shag Harbor tale as well. Our primary sources for contemporary reports from the authorities and civilian witnesses come from a paper called the Halifax Chronicle Herald. And here's most of what we know. On Wednesday, October 4th, 1967, at around 11:20 p.m., multiple witnesses claimed to see the following.
Some reported a row of lights on a craft that was roughly 60 feet long. Now, that's, of course, an approximation, but that was used several times, 60 feet long. And this row of lights on whatever this thing was, the lights at least, because a lot of people couldn't – at least several of the reports couldn't see an object. They just saw the lights because of the distance they were away. But the lights descended down, and there was some kind of noise that was emanating from whatever this was that was – it was reported as like a whistle sometimes as a whooshing sound. And it was almost like – it was akin to, at least some of them said, a bomb falling, or like in a movie you would hear a bomb.
Like, pew!
Exactly. And it was so this it was descending down, right? And then it hovered over the water out there at Shag Harbor, or right outside of Shag Harbor, essentially, hovered over the water just momentarily, and then it began to submerge. And there were some really weird details we're going to get into here with how the light functioned or didn't function. It was very strange, but let's continue along.
Sure. Yes. Yes. The object, or the lights, whatever this was, submerged into the Atlantic Ocean, a famously large body of water.
Which, by the way, if you are in Shag Harbor, to your east, nothing but water. That's it.
Yeah, exactly. And emergency crews, primarily the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, or the RCMP, as our caller mentioned earlier, they arrived within 15 minutes or so, so they're not fooling around. They reasonably assumed this was a plane crash at first, so lives could be on the line and the clock is ticking. The Coast Guard later joins in the search. Initially, civilians and authorities, the way the story goes, noted a thick yellow foam, or specifically a glittery yellow foam. A local fishing boat captain said this was about 80 feet wide, the swath of foam. And it's important to remember that he made this observation in the darkness based on his unaided eyesight. According to the records, no one obtained a sample of this strange substance. So even today, we don't know what it is. We can guess, but we don't know. For about 3 days, the authorities search the bottom of the harbor, and they have no luck. They find nothing. No bodies, no debris, bupkis. They also find, when they contact Halifax and other regional authorities, that no planes were reported missing. And with that, the incident seemed set to be a flash-in-the-pan headline. Local radio reported it. The Chronicle Herald reported it. But it seemed like an unusual sighting that, like thousands and thousands of others, would eventually end up being little more than a footnote in regional history books. This is the important thing. So this happens in 1967, right? It's 2019 now, and this is a famous, world-famous UFO incident. But in, let's say, 1977, this was not the case. Something happened between 67 and today that changed the way the public thinks about this specific night in October. And you know, I know I'm setting us up here, but we will tell you what that moment is. We found it. But for now, let's look at the facts. That's the gist of the story, and there are a couple of problems with it, a couple of contradictions. If we rely just on the articles from the Chronicle Herald, what do we find?
We'll tell you right after a quick word from our sponsor. Well, if we do rely on those Chronicle Herald articles and we just say that that's all we're going to use, we're going to find a couple of things. First is that four teenagers said, and this is a claim, they saw four lights, not three. They said that the lights were yellow or white. So we already hear, like, even amongst a group of people who were from the same vantage, saying they saw maybe slightly different things. They confirmed the lights were descending, coming down from the sky. One of the four kids said the lights appeared to turn off and on or blink in some way. Another kid said that he heard the aforementioned whistling noise, the some sound. So again, one of the four witnesses said, I heard it emitting some kind of sound, but the other kids, the other three, didn't mention anything about a sound until this other person mentioned it. Who knows if that's then some kind of confirmation bias or wanting to be correct if you missed it. Another teen said he heard a loud noise when the lights appeared to hit the water, so some kind of boom or splash. That's where you kind of get that end of the bomb sound. And, you know, if it was a massive object and it impacted the water, there would be some kind of sound.
Sure, yeah.
It just depends on how far away you are if you could hear it, essentially.
If it were indeed a craft 60 feet long, no matter how light it was, it would make an audible noise.
100%. If a UFO falls in the water and no one's around, does it make a sound? Yes. Another thing you're going to find is that a whole separate group of people, in this case a couple other teenagers, said they saw three red-orange lights this time. So rather than white or yellow, descending again from the sky, forming a line at a roughly 45-degree angle. Now, these two, this pair, they were actually driving when they saw this, and they didn't stop the vehicle, and the lights just kind of passed out of view as they're driving around. And you know, you're probably somewhere near the coast over there, and just they're going to be gone, even if they're descending down. So we at least have two vantage points, specifically from the Chronicle Herald, specifically teenagers.
And this isn't the end of our witness list. This is just where the witness list gets a little bit at times murky. But picture yourself looking at an aerial map of Shag Harbor.
And you can pull one up right now.
Now zoom out and take in a bigger region into your aerial view, and there's Halifax, okay? So local radio stations reported a glowing object had been seen by a bunch of people who called their newsrooms, and they reported witnessing strange glowing objects flying around Halifax at around 10 p.m.
So what is our established timeline at this point? When did the impact hit the water? Have we established that yet?
It would be before midnight.
Yes.
But after 11:20.
Exactly. Okay. So an hour and change beforehand, all over Halifax, and Ben, as you said, like not a significant distance away, but far enough away. An hour before that, you see lights, glowing objects. Got it.
Right, yeah, and it would be helpful for us to say that distance, right? It's about from Halifax, Nova Scotia to Shag Harbor, Nova Scotia, you're looking at about 255 kilometers or 158 miles.
So that's pretty far.
That's according to distancebetweencities.net.
Oh, that's great.
That's just their thing.
Unless it's a driving distance of some sort.
Right. So the radio stations are reporting this, and they're not the only ones. Air Canada Flight 305 noted something strange on the left side of their plane at 7:15 p.m., and they called it a brilliantly lit rectangular object with a string of smaller lights trailing the object. At 7:19, the pilots noticed a sizable silent explosion near the object, and 2 minutes later, another explosion occurred, and it faded to a blue cloud around this thing, whatever it was they saw.
I read that, all I hear is force field of some sort that got hit or like reacted. Okay.
Yeah. So we know they saw something unusual, but we don't know necessarily whether that is tied to this stuff that happens hours later. This is where we want to introduce our first book, the one that people would consider conspiratorial. Doug Ledger wrote a book called Maritime UFO Files, and in this book he claims that additional witnesses exist. Daryl Dorey and his sister Annette and Daryl's mother were sitting on their front porch when they noticed a large object maneuvering above the southwestern horizon. The next day, Daryl writes a letter to the Royal Canadian Air Force Greenwood Base Commander asking what was flying over the water that evening, because I've never seen anything like it.
And yes, so we've got, you know, two people who saw something and they reported it, which is, you know, always good, especially reporting it to a commander of a base with the Royal Canadian Air Force. That's pretty cool. It's good to know. But then you turn to our next witness, Captain Leo Howard Mercy. Now, this gentleman, you can actually find a memo, because he contacted the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and a report was taken on the 7th of October, 1967, and as pertaining to the 4th, but an actual, you can find a written report. And so, you know, we're saying that this is taken from Maritime UFO Files by Doug Ledger, and it's true. But a lot of times when you're, you know, reading a book like that, it's hard to know whether the sources are legit or real, right? In this case, they most certainly are. So Howard Mercy, Captain Leo Howard Mercy, He was looking at his radar. He's standing on his ship and he's looking at four blips on his DECA radar. They seem to be stationary. But then, you know, he says, well, I want to see what this is. He looks out and he sees about 28 kilometers from where he is on his ship. He could see four bright lights in, again, kind of a formation, like a rectangular formation, roughly, is what he was estimating. And then the entire crew of, I think it was 20, yeah, nearly 20 fishermen who were with him on his ship. They went out, they got on the deck, they watched this thing, this object, whatever it is, this group of objects. They watched it and it was in the northeastern sky. And then this guy, Mercy, radioed the Rescue Coordination Center at the Harbor Master in Halifax and he asked for, you know, something like, hey guys, what's going on over there? And it was one of those things where he reported knowing that the Air Force conducted, you know, testing out in that area where he was looking. So he didn't necessarily think it was anything too off, at least according to the official memo and report. But he did think it was odd. So, you know, he asked for an explanation. He filed this report with the RCMP, and that was about it. At the end of the report, it is noted that he is considered to be a reliable type individual, that's a quote, and bears a good reputation in his community. So that's something that that was noted by the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. So,
which is just them saying that he's considered a credible reporter. He's not pranking people. He's not a crazy, you know, paint-huffing maniac who calls every weekend.
Yes, someone reliable saw this, whatever it was.
So we have these additional witnesses, and there are a few more. But in cases like this, where there's something up in the sky that's not too far into the wee hours of the night, we know that there are almost certainly a bunch of witnesses who saw something and did not go to the trouble of writing to the Air Force station.
Yes.
Because that's a lot of work. So let's go to their initial ideas. Initially, oddly enough, most people are not thinking in terms of anything other than mundane activities, tragedies, meteorological phenomenon. So they first assume, well, maybe this is a boat. Got to search that. Maybe this is a plane. Got to search for that.
Well, and the plane and or boat makes a lot of sense depending on the color of the lights that they saw and if they were flashing or at least on and off in some kind of repeating pattern.
Right, right. That could be a distress signal.
And we did notice that in a few of the witnesses.
True. That is true. Then they said, well, you know what else could fit this story? A distress flare. This is a – for people who are convinced that this was a craft, this feels like a stick-in-the-mud answer. But there are some pretty compelling similarities. So first off, flare guns are standard on boats. Standard on boats, if there's a problem, you use a flare gun. After you fire a flare – have you ever fired a flare?
I have.
They're so cool.
Yeah.
After you fire a flare, then, you know, there's a little bit of a delay before it burns. It might it varies, but it might start burning almost immediately after you shoot it off, or it might hit its arc and then start going downward and then ignite. But this idea with a flare gun inspired some of the more skeptical thinkers to say things like Brian Dunning said, whoosh, whoosh, is it outside the realm of possibility that someone was playing around with a flare gun at 11 at night after killing part of a six-pack?
Or a whole six-pack.
Or a whole six-pack. You know what I mean? Because if you've been drinking, maybe shooting off a flare gun sounds like a cool thing to do.
And just to put it out there, the way – one of the big parts of this story that is so fascinating is how the light landed on top of the water for a little bit and then sunk into the water.
Right. And one of the witnesses, I think in that group of four teenagers, one of the witnesses said a single light remained for a moment before it submerged or before it was put out by the water. So later on, and I mean like months or years later on, people proposed that the sighting could fit the description of something like a falling satellite, which is completely a possibility. 1967, completely a possibility that a satellite may have fallen.
Especially if pieces of it are breaking apart as it's falling and you have multiple lights where fires are burning up pieces of it.
Yeah, absolutely. As it enters the atmosphere. And then it could also be a meteoric fireball. So like a falling satellite, meteors frequently break up during their fall, and that could also look like a line of lights. And depending on the angle of the viewer or your perspective as you're watching this, it could seem to be moving much more slowly than it actually is at kind of a low angle. So the big question immediately here is, did the story change? Here's the thing. After these reports were printed, primarily in the Chronicle Herald, but also in other papers of the time, people began to connect the dots and build what could have been interpreted as separate sightings into a single cohesive narrative. That is, there's nothing wrong with that. That's what people do. We find patterns, we connect dots. That's how our species got to where it is. So the crazy thing that we discovered here is that the foam and the lights were not initially connected. No one initially reported seeing the objects or lights leaving the foam, but people began saying that they saw the lights actually leave the foam behind. So before that point, the foam could have just been something weird that that captain saw. So there we have it for now, this series of spooky lights, if we're going to use the technical term. But how do we get from spooky lights to UFOs? We'll explore that after a word from our sponsor. And against all odds, we have returned. How did this transform from spooky lights to genuine concerns about extraterrestrials being sighted? Well, according to a couple of different sources, this story did not actually take off in the national international sphere until decades later, until 1993, when a ufologist named Chris Stiles said that he witnessed a UFO around the same time and place, several weeks after the initial sighting. He co-wrote a book called Dark Object, The World's Only Government-Documented UFO Crash. In this book, Stiles and his co-author, Doug Ledger from earlier—
Oh, the – what was that book called? The Meteor, the
Maritime UFO Files.
Yes.
So in this book, Dark Object, Stiles and Ledger claim that what people saw that night in Shag Harbor was a spaceship, not just an unidentified flying object, but an unidentified submerged object, or
those
USOs.
Those are my favorite.
Yeah, you introduced me to that concept. And they further trace the path of this object after it submerges in the ocean. They say that after it went underwater, it traveled about 70 clicks northeast to a U.S. Navy facility called the HMCS Shelburne. At the time, the HMCS Shelburne was a support compound for offshore sonar array that was meant to detect submarines. It's part of an anti-submarine system. And this was also part of a larger global network. Back to the book. The authors claim that this USO, unidentified submerged object, met up with another ship underwater. They were monitored by the U.S. Navy, and then they were eventually launched into space. For the record, as near as we can find, Ledger and Stiles were the first people to propose this idea or deposit this series of events, and we couldn't find what their sources were for this claim.
But if you did have information about this, let's say you got it from someone's last words on their deathbed, someone's, you know, no one's ever heard of this before, but this happened, you would be the first person to ever report that. The problem is, you know, why would there be no reporting of that kind of incident, that kind of thing, unless it's just completely redacted and held because it's, you know, national security kind of situation. So it's one of those things we always talk about. We'll get into it a little later, but it's not provable.
Right.
It's not provable either way.
Right. We know that there's enough evidence to say that people definitely saw something. We know little else.
Yep.
Because even the mundane explanations are not perfect one-to-one fits. You know what I mean? So in the case of the flare, if it were a distress flare, we would have probably found an object, right, from which that was shot. If it were a prank by someone who had too much to drink or was just out living their best life on the coast.
Didn't even have to be a prank, just somebody messing around.
Then, you know, how do we explain the fact that no one came forward? Would we just say that they were so terrified that they decided to take the secret to their grave? Because I don't think they would have gotten in serious trouble. But maybe they freaked out because they saw all the law enforcement and rescue responders out there.
Maybe they were like illegal lobster poachers and they didn't want anyone to know.
Yeah, doing illegal flare lobstering.
Well, yeah, they're flaring for lobsters. You know, that's that old standby.
Flaring for lobsters. It's our new T-shirt.
Yep.
So we've got these claims from these authors, and there are more. There are more arguments or theories around, but the claims of Stiles and Ledger are probably the most well-known on that side of the fence. Let's go to the official word, because those of us who may say, well, I'm more of a skeptically minded person and I'm convinced this is a flare, we have weird news for you. The government disagrees. The Canadian government was not convinced. On October 6th, a couple of days after the incident, a Colonel W.W. Turner issued a memo where he said, quote, "The Coordination Center conducted preliminary investigation and discounted the possibilities that the sighting was produced by an aircraft, flares, floats, or any other known objects." And he got that. This is weird. This is probably the strangest piece of trivia I learned doing this. He got that from a telex, an early kind of form of fax, sent from a Coast Guard ship. And it was very short and to the point. You know, essentially it was like telegraph language where they said, we searched for this with nil results. And we searched for this other thing with nil results. All that means is, while they're not totally ruling it out, they're saying they didn't find anything that supports any of those mundane explanations. So even though they didn't find anything, they still didn't feel that the normal explanations fully explained everything. And this sounds sinister, right? It could be seen as a very sinister thing. But we also have to remember, it's kind of predictable. If it were a flare, they're searching the ocean for a flare.
Wait, you mean you can't just dive down there easily with a snorkel and grab it?
It's not like a video game.
Oh,
you know,
dang.
It's not like a mission where you can snag something in the video game. And
it's so true. You'd have to have such specialized equipment to even get to the bottom of the ocean there if you could. And then from that point, you're just going to look for a flare that could be have carried, you know.
That's if it makes it to the bottom.
If it is a flare.
If it is a flare.
What if it was some, you know, extraterrestrial species, just probe, like small little probe, spherically shaped or something that's designed to go down to the bottom of the ocean?
Oh, and then disappear?
Yeah, like burrow into the sand in the ground there.
Okay.
Like if that's what it was, you'll never find it.
maybe that's true with the technology they had at the time, right?
LIDAR.
But now we have LIDAR, yeah. And I think some relatives of Jacques Cousteau actually traveled up a few years back to Shag Harbor to film a documentary about the Shag Harbor incident.
Oh, snap.
So they'll be bringing with them technology that did not exist in the late 1960s. They'll also be working with one of the original members of the dive team that explored the incident when it occurred.
Cool.
And this is where we're at now. This is pretty interesting because there are people who are convinced that this was an accident that got covered up, whether mundane or military or somehow beyond this world in nature. And then there are people who are convinced that this is an easily explainable thing that people – may not necessarily want explained. Because, you see, today Shag Harbor remains a popular tourist destination for local UFO enthusiasts. When the weather's right, you can check out the UFO gazebo and picnic site, and you can look out onto the ocean to the spot where the object crashed.
That's right. Did you say the name of it yet, that place?
Oh, I just said the UFO gazebo and picnic.
Well, there's it's specifically called, and you can find it on Google Maps, the Shag Harbor Incident Interpretive Center. It's a yellow building. I think it's still yellow. You can find it. They mm-hmm. There are phone numbers you can call to reach them, a fax number, and even an email address.
Right. You can also, when you visit, find articles, documentaries, and memorabilia pertaining to the incident.
Exactly. Just something you should know if you are going to go up there, this place specifically, the Shag Harbor UFO Center, it only operates from June 15th until September 30th.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're planning to go, go soon.
You can also contact the Shag Harbor Incident Society, which collects and organizes information about this event. Neat bookending note here, they are headed by Lori Wickens, one of the teenagers who first sighted the object.
Yeah.
He also participated in the Cousteau documentary.
He, by the way. Lori,
yes,
Lori is a he.
So there's where we are, barring some new revelations or deathbed confessions. We want to know what you think. We do also want to point out that there is still a little bit of sketchy documentation on the side of the Canadian government. Let's let them summarize it themselves. Here's the conclusion from the Department of National Defense. The crashing of the unidentified flying object into Shag Harbor is still discussed today, with many articles appearing on the internet. There's no trace of the RCMP reports of the sighting in the files. The Department of National Defense has identified this sighting as unsolved, and the only documentation that exists in the files is a DND memo.
And we have that memo if you want to hear it. Well, then here it is. UFO report, Lower Wood Harbor, Nova Scotia. An RCMP corporal and six other witnesses observed what they believed to be an unidentified flying object off the southwest coast of Nova Scotia, Canada, on the 4th of October, 1967. The object was described as approximately 60 feet in length and was flying in an easterly direction when first sighted. During their observation, the UFO descended rapidly to the surface and made a bright splash as it struck the water. For some time after the impact, a single white light remained on the surface. The RCMP corporal endeavored to reach the floating white object, but unfortunately, before he could reach the location, the object sank. A search of the area failed to produce any material evidence which would assist in explaining or establishing the identity of the object. An underwater search conducted by divers from the Department of National Defense also failed to locate any tangible evidence which could be used to arrive at an explainable conclusion. So literally, what you said, Ben, it's unexplainable, and that's all we got.
Right, so we can easily see why this is so intriguing and remains so intriguing, despite the fact that it is one of the better documented sightings or incidents. There's a surprisingly sparse amount of paperwork regarding it, and some of this came out only when the Canadian government declassified pages and pages and pages of files on unidentified flying objects reports. Now, we do have one pretty I think a pretty cool point that we have to make every time we do a UFO sighting episode. This is a UFO. Any unidentified flying object is, by virtue of being unidentified and in the air and an object, a UFO. That does not mean it was from Alpha Centauri or Mars or some place in the darkness between the stars. It just means that we have no real idea what it is. And even if we as a species have some good guesses, they are still only that. They are only guesses until some sort of hard proof exists. Also, on a personal note, I love that the Department of National Defense is abbreviated to DND.
Yes.
And when I first read the original summarization quote, I had this image in my head that there was a file from a D&D game.
Oh, it was just a game master?
That the RCMP was playing. Like, they were deep into it. Although I'm fairly certain D&D did not exist in the 1960s. Oh, and that fact I forgot to mention, the telex. I never followed up with the weird fact I learned about telex. Okay, so telex or teleprinter is the original form of data transmission and was developed during World War II. It's supposed to be reliably secure over long distances. Now we have faxes. We have emails. We have faxes still for some reason, right? But unlike fax and email, telex has what's called full legal document status in every country in the world.
So
if you send something on telex, it matters.
Yeah, with the fax, it's like, I don't know. I'm going to need a cover sheet. But telex is like, yeah, we got you.
So I thought that was weird because maybe that's the reason why it was so popular. But
God, do you remember sending cover sheets with fax machines?
Yeah. Yeah.
We used to do that in the old office.
Yeah, we had to. It was very strange.
We've been doing this a while, Ben.
We have. We can technically still fax things.
We could if we wanted to.
Have you ever prank faxed people?
Oh, no.
I used to prank fax people at our old office.
What?
I don't know, man.
Sent something Marshall's way?
Not in a mean way.
Yeah.
Not in a mean way. I would fax things like attention for your eyes only. The transmission will begin at, 5:15 or something. Tell no one. Destroy this paper.
It was brilliant.
Fax an optometrist or something.
That is brilliant. Can you get in trouble for that?
Probably. I hope the statute of limitations on prank faxing is pretty low.
Somebody somewhere in an office is listening to this on their break or like while they're waiting, a dental hygienist waiting.
And they're going, you son of a gun. Yeah, but I did fax people at 5:15 as well.
See, there you go.
Just
enough time to get out the door with a little fun, a little light step.
One time it was just like I tried to fax a picture of Christopher Walken, but you mainly fax text through a fax machine. So I don't know what they got. I feel better, Matt. I feel like I have confessed my sins to you.
Oh, well, hey, I love it. And now I want to do it. So if you have ever experienced an unidentified flying or submerged object
or faxed
anyone.
An unidentified faxed object.
Yes. You can reach out to us. We would love to hear your stories. You can give us a call. We are 1-833-STDWYTK. Leave a message detailing what you've seen. You can, like one of our recent listeners first called us and left a message or two, I believe, and then sent us several videos showing what she experienced with some kind of object that she noticed.
That was fantastic. Yeah, thank you for doing that.
Yeah, thank you so much for sending that. You can do that, or you can just leave us a message telling us what happened one time or what you've experienced. You can do all that stuff, or you can reach out to us on Instagram, where we are Conspiracy Stuff Show. And Ben, you are?
I am in a burst of creativity at Ben Bolin. So you can follow me to see me get kicked into and out of various countries on various misadventures.
Perfection. Is there an HSW involved, or is it just
no,
Ben Bolin?
No, no,
okay.
No. Okay. No.
I'm Matt Frederick, HSW something. I don't know. Good luck. You'll never find it. And we have Embryonic Insider, which
that's
is Noel. And Paul is – what is it?
Paul is at Appleby Revolutionary.
Oh, yeah. Applebee's – was it the Applebee's Revolution?
It's either – I think
Applebee's Facts.
Mission Control has several different Applebee's accounts.
Okay.
Which I'm surprised that he finds time for all of them.
You're just going to have to search around and find it. I can't remember. And it was a really complicated name.
Yeah. You have to earn that one.
Yeah.
In the meantime, while you're on the internet, if you want to check out our favorite part of the show, your fellow listeners, hop on over to Here's Where It Gets Crazy, our Facebook page, where you can see you can see a ton of different ideas, some pretty high-tier memes. But then one thing I think that a lot of us enjoy about the page is some in-depth conversation about things.
Specifically about stuff we've covered on the show. Mm-hmm. We'll get into discussion about what something truly meant or like an extra piece of evidence that maybe we didn't see or something. Mm-hmm. It's really great. You should definitely go there.
And as always, a shout out and a huge thank you to the hardest working mods in the business, Sam, Zach, and of course, Kat. Thanks for putting up with us, folks.
1,000%.
If you say, I have a story to tell, I, like most people in these are modern days, hate using the phone, and I listened to your episode about Facebook, that thing's bananas. How on earth can I reach you guys? If you have that problem, we have a solution for you. You can write to us directly. Send us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@howstuffworks.com. Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.